how can we love our children well by how we help them grow being image bearers of God? And we're called to love, we're called to think well, we're called to speak well. Our speaking well will come out of our loving well.
Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Leslie Bustard is a writer, a teacher, a conference organizer, a publisher, and a museum goer, among other things. She loves books, especially children's books, and she has a gift for connecting people and connecting with people. So it makes a lot of sense that she would round up 40 other writers to contribute to a book about children's books. Along with her daughter, Carrie Bustard, and editor, Thea Rosenberg, Leslie Bustard curated and edited Wild Things and Castles in the Sky, a guide to choosing the best books for your children, published by Square Halo Books. Leslie Bustard, I'm so happy that you are on the Habit Podcast today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here too.
So you just through Square Halo Books released Wild Things and Castles in the Sky, a guide to choosing the best books for children.
Yes.
I say you released, you edited and curated along with your daughter Carrie Bustard and Thea Rosenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And you rounded up, what, 40 writers to
write? 40 writers, yes.
Wow.
With Lucy Shaw as the one who wrote the, what is that, the foreword, the you ought to read this book, which was pretty exciting for me.
I guess so. So tell me the story of this book, where it came from, and I want to get around to how you round up 40 writers, but we'll get to
sure.
that. We'll get to that when we get to it.
Okay.
Tell me about sort of the genesis of this book.
The genesis of the book. That's a type of question where I could like take you very far back, like decades ago, or I could just take you like 3 years ago. But
give me the quick decades.
The quick. That sounds good. So I've always loved children's literature. I loved making children's literature a part of our family culture. Mm-hmm. I loved whether it was picture books that were classic looking or picture books that were contemporary, whether they were just well done, chapter books or graphic novels, just I loved having stories in our family culture. But I've also loved one of the things that, like, if you're my friend, I'm probably going to loan you a book. If you're my friend with little children, I'm definitely going to loan you a pile of books. Mm-hmm. And so I've just always loved sharing books and learning about books. But then along the way, I started seeing that other people were actually writing their own books about books, other than the books like I had on my shelves, like Honey for a Child's Heart. You know, I had that book and that was very inspiring. So I was like, wow, I missed out on like podcasts and blogs and books about books. But that was okay too, because I've had the joy of teaching and mostly teaching literature and writing. And I've had the joy of actually producing theater with high school students and children. So my love of stories and giving people stories just came through in different ways. So mm-hmm. I also like, there was a time when I worked at a coffee shop and one of the things I did a reading time for moms who came to the coffee shop with their kids. So really? I've always somehow been able to add in reading and children's literature into my life, even as my daughters got older.
Uh-huh.
But then COVID and cancer hit all kind of at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't remember when this started, but I probably was driving in the car because my ideas always seem to happen when I'm driving in the car. Uh-huh. And I just started thinking about, I don't even remember actually what started the thinking, but all of a sudden I found myself thinking, oh, well, this friend who's a writer, she could write about that topic about children's literature. And I really started listing through people I knew, like some people in the Rabbit Room, some people with Cultivating Project, some mm-hmm. people who were close by, mm-hmm. who were like Lancaster friends. And for some reason, I just started thinking, well, Square Halo is a is a company who loves doing books about with essays with other writers. Like, we really are, we love to partner and collaborate. So, you know, one of the first books that got Square Halo going is It Was Good Making Art to the Glory of God, which was a book of essays. Mm-hmm. And I was sharing with another class this week. I was speaking with a class at Pepperdine with a writing class, and they were asking about that, like, tell us, you know, why was it a book of essays? And I realized that along the way, I only know so much, mm-hmm. and I only have so much time or headspace. I can't really become an expert on all things children's literature, as much as I would like to. But if I brought together other people who have the same loves, but have, like, their expertise or interest might be in a different place, why don't we bring all of those voices together? And so I just started thinking about it. Like, I thought, what would I write about? Which was the introduction essay. Mm-hmm. And I'd already written about those things. I had written that essay in a shorter form for the school, the classical school I used to teach for. And then I wrote it as a different essay for Cultivating Project. So I thought, okay, what would I want to write about? And then who else would I want to write? Mm-hmm. So I talked to Ned about it, and he loved the idea. Then we shared it with our partners, Alan and Diana Bauer, and we've been doing this book publishing company together since we started it. Mm-hmm. And they're as invested as we are. Mm-hmm. And at first they didn't understand. Like, at first they were like, who's going to read a book about essays about children's literature? And I'm like, I would have. So we kept talking about it and kept talking about it. And then the light bulbs went on for them. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh yeah, that sounds great. And some of their thoughts kind of helped me put it together. So that's really where it came from. Like, I wasn't teaching anymore. I wasn't producing children's theater anymore. Uh-huh. I was figuring out life with cancer. Yeah. And it just started from there. So...
Something you said made me, I wanted to understand. It's been a long time since I've seen Honey for a Child's Heart.
Sure.
It's more listy than.
Yes.
Yeah. So you've got essays with lists.
Mm-hmm.
And
So I haven't looked at Honey for a Child's Heart for a while either, but I feel like a lot of the books I looked at mm-hmm. when I was homeschooling and as like a young mom were mostly lists.
Yeah.
Mostly. Mm-hmm. Some of the, like, but Book Girl, was that Sarah Clarkson? Came out like maybe 4 years ago. That mm-hmm. had a lot of like good ideas about how to think about literature. So that was kind of an inspiration for me. How she talked about maybe a genre and then books that had been inspiring and what those books were about.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit of an inspiration as well.
Well, I love that idea that these are essays that give some guidance, and here's how to think about these kind of books. I love the lists, and I was very, even Honey for a Child's Heart, we loved that book. I mean, that was a great resource for us.
Yeah.
And I also love that you're adding to that this, you know, here are some ways to think about this genre, this age group, this.
Yes.
I'm trying to think. You did. There's a section on genre. There's a section on age group.
Yes. Like, we, in the end, what happened is, so my vision was to have an essay about some type of topic within children's literature. Mm-hmm. And it could have been something that dealt with age related, or it could have been like Shakespeare. We have an essay about how to talk about race with your children.
Yeah.
So it's this wide range of topics. And then those essays have books as examples. But then what we asked every writer is, please recommend like your five books that would fit, or your favorite, or you think mm-hmm. fit the best. And they can't be in the essay. and so you've got this just rich plethora of books. Mm-hmm. So in the end, what ended up becoming a joy for me in getting this book pulled together is that it not just talks about the goodness of books, but I feel like as you're reading through this book, for me, it helps me love children even more.
Ooh, tell me about that. Like, that's great.
Like the love that people have, these writers have for children, and the love I have for children, it was inspiring. And I started noticing it when I read the book, the essay by Joy Strawbridge. Now, Joy is, I think you taught Joy's sisters.
That's right.
Julie and Jenna.
Yeah.
So I've known Joy since she was like 10 or 12. She's my daughter Carrie's best friend. I love their family.
Yeah.
And Joy and I
taught Joy in a one-day writing seminar too, actually.
Oh, did
went
you?
Out to her college, yeah.
I love her. So she has been a teacher and she now's a nanny. And her essay is about books for like the fourth grade age group around there, you know, like that's the sweet spot of that essay. But yeah. I think what she's talking about applies to upper elementary. But she's also bringing in not just her experience with that grade, but her love of talking to the children she nannies. Mm. And there's something about, I don't mean to sound cliche, but joyful about her love of children and what she wants to give them. And then I started seeing that that's what other writers were doing as well.
Yeah.
So there's this thread of, we love stories. We are come together because of our faith, because of Jesus.
Yeah.
We know books are important, but so is imagination and how that all helps us love children. Yeah. And that just made me really happy that that's how this book comes across for me. I feel like it's not like you have to read good books to your children so they turn out okay.
Yeah.
It's more like, look at these little people we've been given to steward and love and shepherd, whether they're your children or whether they're the children in your community, whether they're your friends' children or your nieces and nephews or your grandchildren or the children who sit by you at church or your neighbor's children. Like, God has just given us, of course, this sounds obvious, but children, and how can we love them well? You know, how can we point them to the beauty of the kingdom of God and of Jesus by how we love them. So
I love it. And I love the variety. I mean, I hadn't thought in terms of helping us to love children more, but that's exactly what's going on in this book. And I love, you know, the way Corey Latta talks about his son with Down syndrome. And
you should interview him too. He's got a really good C.S. Lewis book.
Okay.
We can talk about that later.
Okay. All right. We'll talk about it later.
Yes, his essay about his child.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's so beautiful. And then some of them are very practical. I mean, I love the way Gypsy Martin talks about it. Here's what you do with Newbery books, right?
Exactly. I love that essay.
Go for the honor book and the second place book.
Exactly.
Because that might be the great, I don't know, just the practicality.
No, Gypsy's essay was one that I would share with like writers who are asking to consider. Uh-huh. As I kept working on this book, I kept being like, we need another topic. Like there's all these topics I wanted to cover. So there's still topics I wish we could do, but Gypsy's essay, I loved how she was like, you know, if you think about Newbery books, they're the good for you books. Mm-hmm. And I loved how she divided up those books in like, I know I'm going to love this book, or this is going to be the good for you book, or it's, I just loved that. I loved the spirit of that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I love it. You know, there are so many of these essays, the writers talk about, here's what it was like for me as a child.
Yes.
You know, Gypsy. That's what Gypsy talked about going to she hated going on errands unless the errand was to the library.
Exactly.
And anyway, there's just so, I think you did a great job, Leslie, of finding the just a panoply of people talking about different facets of the way these I know children's literature is a broad subject and it lends itself to broad treatments, but you did a great job.
It felt very of God.
Yeah.
To be honest, because I just did a lot of praying and a lot of praying, and I had already I already felt like I had rich resources, mm-hmm. like through the rabbit room, through cultivating, through teachers that I knew. But I also knew what I didn't have. And what I really wanted was to show the big picture of God's kingdom, mm-hmm. How God's kingdom is full of people of different races and yeah. different cultures and different countries. And mm-hmm. how can we celebrate that? Like when my children were younger, I loved to go to the library. I mean, I share this and Carrie shares it in her essay. I would go to the library and I loved finding books about children from different countries. Mm-hmm. And I loved finding the authors or illustrators who were from other countries. Mm-hmm. So I was already interested in giving my children like a bigger picture. And there's more that's come out since my daughters were younger that I don't know about.
Yeah.
But I already loved that. But my what comes easy for me is just give me a good story from England. Like mm-hmm. I love either like English stories, or I seem to also love stories about farmers. That just seems to be what I tend towards.
Yeah.
And I also love Shakespeare. And so it would have, and poetry. So it would have been very easy for me to put on my classical teacher hat mm-hmm. and let it be that. But that also isn't what God's world is. Right. And while I was working on the book was when, was also just around all of the hard, it was after all the George Floyd, all of those things were going on. So our family was having a lot of conversations about race relations. And I was listening in to all of those conversations. And I was like, Lord, how do I already felt like this was a good project, but I thought, how else can I make this a project from just thinking big and kingdomly and mm-hmm. connected? And so that became a little bit more of the challenge for me was to find more people of color who could write about children's books. So that kind of goes into how did I keep getting writers is that I contacted Karen Swallow Pryor, who Ned and I knew for several different reasons, and also because Ned had illustrated her on Reading Well book.
Yeah.
And
love that illustration, by the way.
Thank you. I know. I love that too. That came after, you know, after Every Moment Holy. And mm-hmm. when Karen contacted him to do that, we just thought, holy cow, like nothing mm-hmm. better can happen after this. Because Every Moment Holy and Karen Swallow Pryor was like, this is so awesome. So we had a lovely, like long distance, friendship with her and just a good connection. And Karen and I are, she's part of the leadership of something called the Pelican Project, uh-huh. Women thinkers and writers. And so I'm on the Facebook group. And so there are some wonderful women in that group and many women of color. And so I'm looking at them and I'm like, I want them to write for my book. And they're like Jasmine Holmes. And so I reached for the names I knew and I asked Karen if she could connect me with them, and she did. And, but then they're very busy women, and also they have big book contracts. So, but they were very gracious. And the one woman who really connected me in the end, it was Dorina Williams. Mm-hmm. And she's like my hero all the time.
Yeah.
And she said, I can't do this even though I want to, because I've got too many of my own book projects. And she literally said, I love your idea and your project. I love what you want to do. I love how you want to make it bigger. And I love to connect people. So she reached out to her communities and gave me the permission to then reach out to the women that connected with me. So she gave me a list of about 10 women uh-huh. and about six or seven of them wrote for the book.
Yeah.
And that was really wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm also proud of the Habit membership. I think something like six of our writers contributed.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. Yeah.
That made me very happy too.
It's fun to hear about how many, we think of I mean, I've quit thinking of writing this way, but often people think of writing as a solitary act. And it is. I mean, you have to get off by yourself and write.
Yeah.
And yet, as you know, there's so much about community.
Yes.
And I love, I mean, you know, the Bustards are, y'all have a gift for connecting and for knowing people and connecting other people. So I'm glad for the way those gifts are finding expression in Wild Things and Castles.
Thank you. We love to connect because that's what started our married lives in that we got to know Charlie Peacock and his wife, Andy, and they were so generous in our life and connected us with other people as our book publishing company started, that was what was given to us as young people. And I think that has become like part of our married DNA and part of our Square Halo DNA is how God has used other people connecting us to other people. So we want to do that with others.
Yeah. We're at that stage of life, right? Where it's time.
We are. Yeah.
Doing these kinds of things instead of building, you know, our own little
exactly
miles or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk about your opening essay. I love what you do in the opening essay to this book. And you start, not surprisingly, with C.S. Lewis and this idea of when Aslan creates and he says to his creatures, love, think, speak.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Tell me about your what that series, Love, Think, Speak.
Sure. I taught all the Chronicles of Narnia to seventh graders for 3.5 years. And I've always loved C.S. Lewis, mostly because Ned does, and that became part of our life together. And so my first time really teaching Magician's Nephew, I'm reading that section out loud, and I literally stopped while I was reading it. And I was like, I had that epiphany moment. Like, this is Lewis talking about what it means to be made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And that was really big for me as I looked at what Lewis was doing in that part of the story about the creation of Narnia and then thinking about being human and God is, he loves, he speaks, he thinks, and that's what we've been given also. And I just loved seeing that in the story and then to think about that at creation. And as I was sharing about how I was writing about women, the beginning of my teaching for about being a woman, I kind of look at when God says, I'm going to create a helper fit for you. That word is azer, kenedgo, which is the word azo. Azer is used for God when he is the strong helper of the Israelites. And so I share that because I keep going back to Genesis. Like everything always for me goes back to Genesis. And I think that's funny because sometimes I'm like, do I have to read Genesis again? But it's so rich. And I think because my head space was in Genesis, that's why I saw it, why I connected that love, think, speak, being made in God's image as women and men are made in God's image. And I've always really cared about words. For me personally, how words are put together, how I've loved theology, I've loved well-written, like, I mean, we all do if we're listening to The Habit, but how a lot of stories and how words are put together have, I think, kept me connected to being a Christian and to God. And so I've always felt that heavily also for parenting. And as I went into then teaching and seeing how it's so easy for myself to get caught up in culture and words that aren't good for my heart and how easy it is to let our kids just sit in front of a TV or sit in front of technology or play video games. I know how easy it can be for me, but how I wanted to purposefully give good stories and art to my children, at a young age, whether it was going to museums and talking about what we saw or reading poetry to my kids when we were having breakfast mm-hmm. on a Saturday and eating pancakes. Like, I tried to figure out, how can I be purposeful? Mm-hmm. We're not always that family that would have deep conversations in the car, but we would. Yeah. We also just love listening to pop music in the car, but feeling very aware of what's feeding our imagination. And then just thinking about that idea that words are like swords to the heart, or they're like honey, or, you know, what's in your heart is what's going to come out of your mouth. And so all of those things have always been something that has either been life-giving to me or makes me want to work really hard to help the people in my life have good words in their life. So I think that's where that essay came from, was how can we love our children well by how we help them grow being image bearers of God. And we're called to love. We're called to think well. We're called to speak well. Our speaking well will come out of our loving well, right? Mm-hmm. What do we love? So Marilyn McIntyre has a book, Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies.
That's a great book.
That when I discovered that book, I just felt like someone who knew more than I knew had said everything I had been kind of intuitively thinking about, but had put it down in beautiful chapters.
Yeah.
So that book, as well as James K. Smith's You Are What You Love, also things that I had been thinking about and thought about intuitively, he was saying much better than I could. So it was all of those things put together. It was good. A friend had read that essay and he said, is this true for you? Like, this is good. But like, and I said, oh no, I don't want it. I don't want this essay to be a burden, because life is messy. Our hearts are messy. Kids' hearts are messy. Things are broken. I don't want it to be a burden, but I want it to enlarge people's imagination and vision. And I think that's what I also want for this book. It's easy. When I was a homeschooling mom, if I wasn't reading someone like Madeline L'Engle or Edith Schaefer, many times other homeschooling people who are writing to moms or homeschooling moms, they burdened me with their ideas because I felt like I couldn't reach their lofty goals for life, or I wanted their outcome, which I thought looked really good, which I assumed was good, but turns out everybody's just messy. Okay. So especially when I was younger and my kids were younger, I put too much burden from reading other people. So I don't want my essay to be a burdensome. I want it to enlarge their vision or imagination for how they think about life.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a minute. What your friend who said, do you really do this? And maybe was suggesting that it's burdensome. What's the, this, because our listeners haven't read
the
essay.
Am I careful in my conversations with, so I talk about like, we need to be having good conversations with our children, or giving them those good books to be reading. We need to be giving them good stories. Mm-hmm. Not that we're all perfect and we're lofty thinkers. You know, we will sit and binge watch West Wing together, but I did take my kids to museums, and I didn't talk a lot of, like, Ned made sure I didn't talk too much about the paintings. We would walk around museums and play games about the paintings, like, which one would you steal, or which one is mommy's favorite, or which one's your favorite, you know? Uh-huh. But, or we would share our favorite music, or we read books out loud to each other. I did read poetry to my kids when I would make pancakes, you know, and when they come home, if they're in the mood, I'll say, okay, I'm going to read poetry to you. So those are things that I did too.
So can you talk to me about the difference between burdening a reader with good ideas and enlarging, liberating, these kinds of things?
That's such a good question, because I really did wrestle with that a lot. And I feel like I still, even in relationship with young moms, I'm like, what is going to be burdensome to you? Or what is going to be helpful to you? Diana Bauer, who's one of our partners and has known me since I was like 22. So she's been a lifelong friend. We're very different in who we are as people. And so when I found Edith Schaefer's Hidden Art of Homemaking, like freeing for my life, mm-hmm. like it opened up and I was like, everybody should read this book. She said, maybe not. Maybe she speaks your language and that's helpful to you. Mm-hmm. But there might be someone who comes from a totally different background and that book's not going to speak to her. It could be more burdensome because she doesn't get it. I don't know how to exactly answer that question because there will be people who read it and it will hurt. It will feel hard.
Yeah.
Either because their background isn't one that they were given that. And so they're going to be feeling like they're pushing a big boulder up the hill and it's falling back on them, you know, when it comes to trying to introduce literature or whatever. So I don't know how to answer that. But when I did write that essay for the school where I taught, and then I think I did this with Cultivating, I gave a list of here are things you could do to think about, like areas, how can we put our children in the pathway of good words, like going to church together, worshiping together, serving together as a family, eating meals together, going out on nature walks, or like, so one of the things I try to do, even when I'm talking about being an Azer or being a necessary ally in your people's lives, which isn't what I talk about in the book, but it's another topic I love to talk about, is, you know, what are the things that God has given you that you love, mm-hmm. or are your, like, that's what you connect to. Don't hide it from mm-hmm. your people. Share it, but share it with open hands. Because there are times when I wanted to give my kids what I loved, which was poetry and good stories and foreign films and artwork. And I wanted to give it to them because I wanted to have a certain outcome. And I realized that I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I couldn't make them become little me's because really that's not great because I got a lot of issues too. Yeah. But I knew it was I knew my wanting to give it to them was one because I knew it was good things to give them.
Yeah.
So that's good. But I also wanted a certain outcome because I was also homeschooling and you feel that burden of homeschooling or in parenting, right?
Yeah.
So I had to learn over time to give it as a gift out of the things that I loved in my heart and then allow God to then use those seeds to cultivate in them what needed to be cultivated.
Yeah. No, I think that's so important to think in creative work that I've got what I can give.
Yeah.
I don't know. And it's not going to be for everybody.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I call it the fondue pot principle because.
Oh, I love that. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Because when I needed a fondue pot, I put out a call on Facebook for a fondue pot. And only one person came back and said, I've got a fondue pot that you can use. I'm like, thank you for that fondue pot. And I wasn't mad at all those other people who gave me one, right? He had what I needed. We connected.
Yeah.
Great. And thankfully I didn't have to own a fondue pot because that would just take up space.
Right. Exactly.
But that idea that nobody's mad at you for for the gifts you don't have. They just want the gifts you do have. And I think we spend
some
time thinking, you know, I don't have, and I've got to improve all those areas that don't come naturally to me.
Right.
And on the other hand, spending a lot of time talking about what if what I do have is not what everybody needs.
Exactly.
Well, you get what you have.
Right.
And somebody needs it. You don't have everything and not everybody needs what you have.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe that's part of the answer to the question of how do you distinguish between what's burdensome and what's
exactly
and what's freeing. That's not your problem.
Right.
You get what you can get.
Exactly. And those are things exactly what you're saying. I've needed to come to that. The other thing that's been a big vision caster for me in how I want to live my life and live my life in community and creatively is Makoto Fujimara's idea of culture care and being generative. Mm-hmm. When I read his essay about that, like more a decade ago, about giving, having Genesis moments how can I give people Genesis moments? How can I be generous to people, not live in a place of scarcity in myself, but give out of what I have? And how can I think generationally? How can I take what's been given to me and move it forward to the people, young or old, in front of me, so that then they can be have seeds? Like, I want to think about what I do mostly as seed planting. And so that's taken me a long time to get to that, because I did really struggle in my, at different times, like in my 30s and 40s, in being a homeschooling mom and just a mom, of anxiety of like, oh, how can I help my kids turn out to be okay? Whatever okay is. How can I help them grow up to be people who love just really great movies and Jane Austen and will only pick the best music or whatever? How can I do that? And in the end, they have to have their own stories. I have to be the one who plants the seeds. So the other thing I love is Charlotte Mason's idea of living books. I didn't discover Charlotte Mason until farther along in my journey of being an educator. But when I share this a lot, and Carrie shares it, but when C.S. when I read C.S. Lewis talk about, like, if an adult can't enjoy a book, then we shouldn't be giving a children's book to a child if an adult can't enjoy it. And he says that, and Madeleine L'Engle said that. And I read that around the same time when I was in my 20s. So I discovered, as I was giving reading books to my kids, literally, if a book was twaddle or awful because of its words or its illustrations, my stomach would start to hurt. Like, it was this anxiety pressure in my gut. And that book did not stay. I might read it once, and then somehow I would find a way for myself not to read it. And then after a while, it would not stay in the house. And that, and then I would share that with moms, and I'd be like, they'd be like, I can get rid of books. I'm like, of course you can get rid of that book. Like, you don't have to keep bad books in your house. So,
All right. I want to, the last topic I want to broach before the question about which writers make you want to write. That's a, I guess that's a spoiler. is when you talk about Marilyn, you're quoting Marilyn Robinson in this introduction.
Marilyn McIntyre.
Yes, sorry. Thank you.
I understand. I love Marilyn Robinson too.
And in my notes, I wrote Marilyn Nelson. So, so we've got all kinds of Marilyns floating around here. Yes, Marilyn McIntyre. Thank you. She says, she talks about this idea that we derive our basic expectations from the narrative patterns that we internalize as a part of the reason we give our kids stories is to give them narrative patterns. And that's a common enough idea. But I love the language that she uses, where she says, stories help us negotiate the open middle ground between predictability and surprise.
Yeah.
Which is what life, navigating life, feels like.
Yes.
You know, I think I know what's going to happen, and I'm usually wrong.
That's
not that I'm usually wrong. You're right most of the time at what's going to happen.
Right.
But then when that surprise comes, that really makes life interesting. I mean, if you were to dress every for weather, if you were to dress every day according to what the weather was like the previous day, you'd be right a lot of the time.
Sure.
And then you'd really find yourself freezing.
Be really wrong. Exactly.
Because, you know, it's true that that things are predictable, but then they're not. Exactly. And just a little bit of unpredictability. And I just kind of thinking about this idea of what's predictable and what's not, what's surprising and what's not. And for a child, everything's surprising.
It's so true.
And but when then, they haven't established their patterns of what's to be expected. And I love that thought with regard to, you know, while their minds are still plastic, they're still open to the, to surprise. When you tell them that a pearl comes from an oyster, and they look at the pearl and look at the oyster and they go, if you say so.
Exactly. You know,
I mean, the world is a really surprising place.
It is. But then you find that they also need, they need, most kids in some way or another, or maybe it's just me, needs that well, Ned would tease me and call it a rut, and I would call it rituals. Like, what are we having for breakfast? Okay, these are the three things I usually have for breakfast, or this is what we do before we go to church, or this is the little routine we have before bedtime. Mm-hmm. And if you take them out of that routine, then getting them into bed isn't gonna work. Mm-hmm. Maybe at least that's the kind of some of the experiences, you know, that we've had. All of my children have said, as much as they love the surprises, they're also like, you know, you have to live in the house you're living in now until we have children and they can have their, you know, their childhood, you know, coming to the house we grew up in, you know? So, and I'm like, oh, there's so many interesting houses I might want to go live in. You know?
I got to thinking about,
I love that,
about Cheston talking about, we tell stories about golden apples to try to,
yeah,
all the time when we were really excited that apples were green.
Exactly. I love that too. Just the learning to be, and I think this is how I want to live, and how can we help other people live this way? Like, have an enchanted view of what's outside in the world, or what's inside other people, or you know, what's inside, what are the new things we can learn in history, or what are the new things we can learn in scripture? Mm-hmm. I've been reading, our church is reading, Lowly and Humble,
Gentle and Lowly.
Thank you. Yeah. And he talks often about how we think we know how Jesus is going to respond to us, especially in regards to our sin, and that we think that he's going to be either mad or not want to come near us, but really his heart is so for us, mm-hmm. that when we're so stuck in a sin pattern or in a sin issue, his heart is to come near to us, mm-hmm. and to help us and to love us even more. And the more I read that, that is surprising to me. I don't think I've always lived that way. Like, I know Jesus died on the cross to atone for my sins, but I think I most of the time, whether I voiced it or it's just somewhere hanging out in my subconscious, you know, in the back of my brain, I'm thinking, why would God want to have anything to do with me when I'm still struggling with this thing?
But
he keeps showing us. So that's the surprise I keep coming to. It's not, Jesus isn't predictable in that way, except he is, in that he surprisingly wants to keep coming towards me, and he wants me to know I am beloved.
Yeah.
And when I'm in my deepest sorrow of my sin, he's there for me.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, Dane Ortlund and I talked about that very thing on this podcast, the idea
of
surprise as essential, as a theological concept. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So that's, I love that book.
All right.
We gotta stop talking.
Oh, okay.
So, but you have to, before you leave, you have to tell me, who are the writers who make you want to write?
I'm going to just focus on the writers who make me want to write, not the ones who have like inspired me in how to live or.
Yeah, no. We don't care about living here. Just
I understand. So I would say Lucy Shaw, mm-hmm. Has been a consistent, like since my 20s, when I discovered her through my reading of Madeline Lingle, she has been the person who has made me want to write. I started praying last year to God, and I'm like, I love poetry and I want to write it. And I want to write poetry that I don't hate. And I've been working on that, and I don't hate my poetry.
Oh, great.
So I less love how Lucy and her poetry helps me see the glory of being human in the world, mm-hmm. that's made by God and loved by Jesus. So I love Lucy Shaw and her writing. She makes me want to write. I can never say his name right.
Seamus
Heaney makes me want to write. I want to have a depth of words and love and life experience and generosity like he does. Mm-hmm. I love him. I love listening to him read his poems. I love listening to my Irish friends read his poems. And I just want to write like him. Marilyn McIntyre makes me want to write.
Yeah.
I love her.
Yeah,
I love
her prose. She makes you feel like it's important and that it's worth doing.
Oh, yes, exactly. That's exactly why I want to write, is what you just said. Why she makes words. She's helped me see the importance of words. Yeah. I love her poetry and her prose and listening to her speak. Walter Wangerin, Eugene Peterson, Frederick Buechner make me want to write. Like, they're my like classics, you know? I mean, also Tolkien and Lewis, but I've loved Wangerin and Peterson and Buechner longer than I've loved Tolkien, to be honest. And John Newton makes me want to write. His letters make me want to write in a way
Oh,
they're beautiful. I try to read them. I would like to say every year, but usually every other year. Yeah. And many times I just jump into a section and I'll read it. But his shepherding heart and his way he expresses grace to people is, it astounds me. Wow. And it shepherds my heart. And I want to write like that. Like, I want to write in a way that draws people to Jesus that way. And there's some, can I keep sharing? Is that okay?
Sure, let's hear it.
Okay. So there's some new women. There's some women I've been introduced to. So Dorena Williams.
Right. Oh yeah.
And, Hannah Anderson, I love, she makes me want to write.
Yeah.
And Naomi, I don't know how to say her name, but Naomi Shahab Nye. She's a poet. Oh,
yeah.
I love her.
She's great.
The way she uses words.
Yeah.
I want to write poetry like hers. I want to have her heart. I want to have,
I love that poem, the fish is famous to the river.
Yes. That's one of the first ones that made me go, I love that. She has a poem about kindness. I love her poetry. And I love Metallie Perkins writing.
Yeah.
I want to be, I love her.
I just talked to her last week. She's coming. She has an episode of The Habit coming up.
I love that. And she's in our book. There's an interview of her in our book. That makes me happy. And just to wrap up, I want to write because the people in Cultivating, I love my friends at Cultivating. I want to write
what they're doing over there.
Me too. So,
all right, Leslie Bustard, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that this book is in the world, and I hope a lot of people read and benefit from it.
Me too. And I'm grateful that you read it and that we're here talking about it. So thank you.
The Habit Podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. To check out more of our podcasts, visit rabbitroom.com/podcast. Our work at The Rabbit Room would be impossible without the generous support of our membership. If you'd like to learn more about membership at The Rabbit Room, visit rabbitroom.com/member. And thanks for listening.
The Habit membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.